Hi, my name is Brooke Wise, and this is Zoogma. Today, we're talking surveillance. And while it's probably safe to assume nobody really thinks guys in trench coats pretending to feed the ducks when you hear that word anymore, the practice of surveillance has become so widespread and so everyday that it's hard to offer a stereotype of what exactly it is anymore. Facebook stalking? Closed-circuit TV? Chip-equipped passports? Internet monitoring? Phone taps? These examples seem very different, but they all have one thing in common. If they're not the direct result of modern technologies, they've been made vastly easier as the direct result of advances in automation, communication, and machine learning algorithms. In this third episode of Season 2, I'm going to tell you about one surveillance technology which I encounter on a daily basis, but one which passes unnoticed, received as one of the more novel conveniences of life on the University of Texas campus, and I talk with Simone Brown, Professor of African and African Diaspora Studies, about ways in which surveillance can be turned back on itself, and the possibilities of art as resistance. How much does your barista know about you? There's a coffee robot on campus here at the University of Texas. It's a big box at the top of the stairs above the DWRL, recently reclad in walnut panelling where it had been a shiny space-age white. At each of the doors to the building, there's a sign. A robot that makes coffee? Coffee made by a robot? It has a babysitter, which means it's not available into the wee hours of the night, which you'd think would be its main selling point over the Starbucks across the road. And I kind of hate it. Not because I think the new wood panelling is disingenuous, although I do. Not because I think the signs are kind of smug, although I do. Not because coffee is as much art as science, and anyway I think jobs for humans are important, although I do feel pretty strongly about that last one. I hate the coffee robot because it's creepy, because it collects, stores, and displays personal information in ways that are deeply problematic and invasive, because it surveils us, and because it makes the products of that surveillance public. Let me tell you a story. A year or so ago, the coffee robot was shiny and new, and I'd never used it. I never really wanted to. A lot of people have this kind of Star Trek experience with the coffee robot, requesting their drink, which then manifests behind a shiny door at the other end of the box. I had sci-fi expectations too, but something more like in The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, where you request a cuppa from the machine, and it presents you with something that's almost, but not quite, entirely unlike tea, or in this case, coffee. But one day I was running late, and I was desperately under-caffeinated, so I stopped at the coffee robot. I swiped my card, I ordered my coffee, sulking for a second over the limited options presented, and then I wondered why it never asked me what my name was. The answer? Because it takes your name directly from the bank card you swipe, and when your drink is ready, it displays it on the screen in full view of the entire ground floor of the building, one of the busiest on campus. This is a problem for a lot of people, for a lot of reasons. It might be as simple as not wanting that slightly creepy bloke from your 8 a.m. French class to know your name. But it can also be a much more pressing issue of personal safety. If you're gender non-conforming, and the name on your bank card is gendered in a way that doesn't match your presentation, that kind of outing can pose a real and immediate threat to your well-being and your safety, and that's not okay. Now, because the coffee robot was shiny and new, and because it's a prototype being tested on UT students before it's rolled out to an airport near you, the marketing and design teams are often around, a cluster of half a dozen dudes in suits, watching people buy stuff from the robot. And on this day, the team were standing around while I ordered my coffee. While I waited, one of the men came up to me. He introduced himself, and he asked me how I was enjoying my coffee robot experience. And I looked at him and I said, "Well, let me tell you what I think about the coffee robot." And I did. I told him that I thought the way the coffee robot used personally identifiable information was a problem. I told him that I objected to my name being taken directly from my card, with no notice and no opportunity to opt out, not even by just, you know, walking away and not buying my coffee from the robot. I told him that I thought it put many people at risk, in different ways. I told him it was unethical, and I told him I wouldn't be back. The guy kind of looked at me like I was a crazy person, but since he's in marketing, he smiled and nodded, and told me they'd never thought of these issues, and they would take it all under advisement. And then he went back over to the rest of the suits, and I thought that would be the end of it. Several minutes later, the robot isn't as fast as you might expect either. The guy comes back over to me. He's been thinking about what I said, he tells me, and he's really sorry to hear that I've had a bad experience with the coffee robot. To make up for it, he says, he's brought me a voucher for another coffee and a t-shirt, all rolled up and tied with a pretty bow. I left the coffee voucher in a classroom for someone else to use and donated the t-shirt. I haven't ordered another coffee from the robot, although I walk past it almost every day. The suits are still there every week or two, and it still takes your name directly from your card and flashes it up on the screen. You can now sign up online for an account and attach a fake name to it. My colleague Jake here at Zygma is known as George Clooney to the coffee robot. But that does nothing to help the casual user. And that situation is unconscionable, given how trivial it would be to program in a text entry field. This kind of everyday surveillance is utterly unremarkable, and consequently, it goes unremarked. This makes it all the more dangerous, and scary, and infuriating when it's dismissed because it's just coffee. It's not. The implications go way beyond a robot knowing how much milk you want. So coffee? Made by a robot? No thanks. I've got a French press around here somewhere. So, now that you've heard all my many feelings about the coffee robot, let's shift gear a little. As I alluded to in that story, surveillance has a disproportionate impact on the everyday lives of queer communities, people of colour, and other minorities, even when that surveillance is not explicitly targeted at them, as it often, indeed usually, is. But of course, there's always space for resistance. I spoke with Simone Brown of the University of Texas's Department of African and African Diaspora Studies. She's an expert in surveillance studies. From stop and frisk to naked scanners, we explore the relationships between race, gender, and surveillance, as well as ways to resist it through artistic practices and turning the surveillant gaze back on the dominant culture. Whispering sweet treason inside your ear, because I just want you to notice me, but don't know what to say, except freedom fighter, anthrax powder, terrorists, and hello, hello, hello NSA.
Okay, my name is Simone Brown, and I'm an assistant professor in the Department of African and African Diaspora Studies at the University of Texas at Austin. Mm-hmm. My work is on surveillance studies broadly. Mm-hmm. Well, I first got into it from the Surveillance Project, which was in Queen's University in Ontario, Canada. Mm-hmm. It's now the Surveillance Studies Center, and it was really run and created by David Lyon, who's, I guess, one of the founders of the field of surveillance studies. Mm-hmm. Right now, I just finished a book that's tentatively called Dark Matters, mm-hmm. on the surveillance of blackness, which sounds like a really broad subtitle, because it's kind of like everything.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I wanted to really think about, I guess, a basic question, like what would happen to surveillance studies if we were to center the conditions of blackness, mm-hmm. whether it's the historical or the present or the historical present, that I thought was interesting is like, mm-hmm. Social media, which I mm-hmm. teach about.
Right.
Today we talked about Facebook surveillance,
yeah.
and identity theft, mm-hmm. and these things online. But I also just like as just looking at what's happening on these social spaces, mm-hmm. like so many ideas of how we're thinking of surveillance or also teaching,
yeah.
and contingent labor in this mm-hmm. moment. All of these questions are being really hashed out,
yeah.
on Twitter in 140 characters.
Yeah.
And so when we think about how people also play with surveillance, mm-hmm. but also use those spaces to challenge marginalization.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, there's one person that I follow. I actually don't even know her name. Some people I know by handle.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's DN Lee @DN Lee. And she was, yeah, the blogger for Scientific America who
yeah.
was, you know, asked to really labor for free.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, many people know this story, but when she refused, she was then called an urban whore.
Mm-hmm.
Are you a you know, a biologist or an urban whore?
Yeah.
And which was a really kind of an insult, and But what was interesting about that is that so many people that were online at that moment on these Twitter spaces that followed her or other people were able to kind of mobilize. And you see that happening in many ways with this kind of hashtag activism, if it's whether it's solidarities for white women or something. It's always every day there's actually one that if I'm at work and I miss it, and I see, you know, what was the discussion happening? Yeah. And that's really exciting for me to think about how, you know, we talk about the digital divide, where some people don't have access to smartphones or maybe still on dial-up, but still can enter dialogues in some ways through these mechanisms. And so that way, it's kind of a little bit of around surveillance, or maybe it's kind of like surveillance, a kind of inverse of surveillance or surveillance from below, where people are using this technology to kind of shine a light on practices like asking a black woman to labor for free and then calling her this. And then with the things like screen capture, you can make those more visible.
What that really threw into relief was that the possibility of instant mobilization.
And I mean, like, there is literally one every week. And whether it was, you know, that the president of the school, I think it was in Georgia, who made the 3/5 compromise into like his own thing. And it was just like, oh my gosh, black Twitter, go and get them. So I think social media, particularly Twitter, is a really interesting space for black women at this moment. And so whether it was the one author that was I think it was like 2 summers ago, wrote something about black women being inherently ugly or whatever it was, to even organizing now for Renisha McBride, who's a 19-year-old, who, you know, there's stories are changing as to where, was it a body dump or was she, but she, the autopsies did say that she, the coroner did say that she was murdered, and there's no release of the person who killed her's name, no arrest yet. And so what the kind of pressure that people can use, something starting on a Twitter stream like Dreen Hampton or other people, and then getting a kind of mainstream reaction to it to call some kind of accountability that black women's lives matter. Yeah. And you can still see that with like people organizing around Marissa Alexander to kind of really press Angela Corey in Florida to really take up this case properly for some justice. So in those spaces, those are kind of very productive moments of these technologies, as opposed to some people might see them as like e-waste. Even something like Dronestagram, where they're using Instagram to kind of map, give people a visual of what happens when a site is hit from a drone in that very kind of Instagram aesthetic. Yeah. But those are some things that, you know, that we're using these technologies to mash up and to ask questions and really to critique state practices.
For me, what I find kind of curious about it is that when you have this kind of hyper-publicity of certain forms of surveillance, what does that do in terms of the recognizability of all of those other like everyday, uncommented forms? You know, does it, you know, in distracting from it, maybe serve to normalize it in...
But it gets back to that thing that you said about like whose bodies or what kinds of subjects are like always and already presumed to be supposed to be under surveillance. That's how we understand it. That's how the order. And so it's an affront to you know, that's people's ideas of their, some people's ideas of their rights to be surveilled in this manner. And I think people's memories are quite short, because we can even think back 2 years ago when it was 2010, when John Tyner had this "Don't touch my junk."
We can do that out here, but if you touch my junk, I'm gonna have you arrested.
Actually,
security is everyone.
We're gonna have a supervisor here because of your
story. And it went kind of viral and created this whole movement that even like South Park did a parody of it.
I always really enjoy like the, you know, the radiolucent printing on the t-shirts.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
The stuff that only becomes visible in that moment of invasion.
Yeah,
as well.
It was like protect the fourth underwear or something like that.
The don't touch my junk underwear.
Yes, yeah. And there was this one, Roth is his name, an artist, and he would use these a kind of like metal plates that would only come, that would show up on the x-ray, like nothing to see here. And so those are things that I, like, I think my next project are looking at, like, those arts performance of surveillance and fashion as well too, and aesthetics, and to think about some resistances in those spaces through art and fashion. And I had to, you know, propose a new project, and I was thinking about the idea of, so Steve Mann is a professor at University of Toronto, and he came up with that term surveillance, so it's a more kind of an inverse of surveillance, and really turning the gaze back on to, I guess, a bureaucratic spaces that watch us, whether mm-hmm. it's he goes sometimes into a Sears store and has a kind of covert recording and interviews with a kind of street level bureaucrat mm-hmm. or a sales clerk worker. You know, what's that camera there? What's it doing?
Yeah.
And then they might say it's a camera, or they might say, oh, it's just the air conditioning. And then he would like open up a more obvious, it would look like kind of like a Flavor Flav clock, and like open up it is actually a camera. Uh-huh. And then to see the reactions of people when they're confronted with the surveillance gaze mm-hmm. in that way. And so it's kind of like what he calls it is a kind of performance as inquiry or inquiry as performance. And so using kind of that, I wanted to look at one thing that was interesting to me was in the Trayvon Martin killing and the 911 tapes, and Zimmerman says, oh, he's wearing a hoodie, a dark mm-hmm. hoodie. And there's a lot of been take up about around this hoodie, we are Trayvon Martin, mm-hmm. we are not Trayvon Martin. To use Steve Mann's work on surveillance, to use the hoodie mm-hmm. as a way to kind of have wearable computing as a kind of aesthetic resistance. So what would it mean to make a hoodie that's kind of equipped with a surveillance camera mm-hmm. as you move through city spaces that are increasingly being saturated with closed circuit television,
yeah.
whether it is a CCTV camera in a private private mm-hmm. like store that but shining on a public space.
Right.
And so what are our kinds of ways that we move through the city always hypermediated, and how does that get also played out with gender and race? Mm-hmm. So what would it mean if I wear that hoodie and record my experiences
yeah.
Through that? And so that's what I'm interested in now, to kind of take some of the theory I do mm-hmm. and have what can kind of arts-based inquiry add to that mm-hmm. In that moment in the spaces. So that's one thing that I'm kind of excited for my Flavor Flav yeah. talk in a hoodie, something like that, maybe at yeah. the back, and that. So that's the kind of new project I'm thinking about to really augment Steve Mann's work on mm-hmm. surveillance, to think about a concept of dark surveillance mm-hmm. and link that to long histories of resistance mm-hmm. And passing and these things that you'd find within like Black diasporic theorizing.
Could you talk a little bit more about the gendered experience of?
So we did talk a little bit about some of the kind of readings I've been looking at, the people that have experienced Stop and Frisk.
Right.
And even though a lot of the research is coming out of New York, you see these practices happening, you know, globally in Toronto, mm-hmm. in Florida, and other spaces. And so, one thing that would happen is that many people who are transgendered or gender nonconforming mm-hmm. would experience have reported that they've been told, well, they're trying to assign gender by doing their patting down, and will experience that as an assault, or because their IDs might not match up in the officer's
right.
Eyes with the name or gender presentation mm-hmm. that might be cause for a citation. But some people have also reported that because their purses are seen as, they call them lungeable objects, so then they are subject to search in that moment. And if a condom is found, mm-hmm. it could be links said that they are evidence
yeah.
of sex work, when really sex workers probably wouldn't carry around condoms because they know it would be considered yeah. evidence of sex work.
Yeah.
And so that's one way in which women are feeling these practices differently,
mm-hmm.
and also transgender people and also queer communities, queer of color communities in New York also experience kind of saturation of mm-hmm. policing, and then which would make these stop and frisk even more violent and racially charged.
Yeah.
And it's like, you know, what Angela Davis calls in the prison, this strip search and cavity search as like a state-sponsored assault, right?
Yeah.
It was some term like that that she used. Mm-hmm. But you could also expand that to look at these stop and frisk, that
yeah.
when it's happening, when it's whose bodies get to be made in this kind of a spectacle
mm-hmm.
and or in quite spectacular violence,
yeah.
and long histories of women's bodies and women of color's bodies being on display
right.
In these spaces
yeah.
and publicly displayed.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's some kind of reverberations, and I think that's the kind of work that I, at least the questions I feel my work answers
right.
or at least attempts to
mm-hmm.
is like, how do we look at things like slave branding or the branding of slaves
yeah.
and link that to contemporary branding. Whether it is branding as a citizen to pass through a border more easily, like a trusted traveler program.
Mm-hmm.
So that's quite a stretch that I made there, I'm quite sure. But I try to make, those links around mm-hmm. racialization and biometric technologies and branding as well, too.
Yeah, I think it's so important to be able to identify those historical arcs,
mm-hmm,
right? To be able
mm-hmm.
to identify the same phenomenon across many, many Because you see exactly the same thing manifested in so many genres, in so many...
Yeah, because they're so recent histories. Yeah, yeah, and they're still unresolved and unfinished. Let's get this on. About to miss my flight. Come on. I went to the airport to catch my flight. The TSA put me in the naked body scanner line. I don't want radiation, so I opted out. But when they grabbed my man junk, I couldn't help myself. I had to shout. I had to shout. I had to get my message out. I said, don't touch my junk. Don't touch my junk. I'll have you arrested if you touch my junk. That's it from us here at Zoogma for today. We'll be back in 2 weeks with an episode on sports and fan cultures. In the meantime, you can keep an eye on what we're up to, by which I mean, of course, surveil us, albeit in a fairly benevolent fashion, on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll join us again next fortnight.